talk about that speech I didn't make, the one yeah. I was talking about, at least I told you about the captain. Mm-hmm.
This is a continuation,
of
the last tape, Alma. I'll start again presently. Well, we'll go on. After Korea, you did the Imperial Defense College, and then, after some shore appointments, you went as a post-captain to Bonaventure.
Yep.
You've summarized how you were captain of Bonaventure, Jeffrey Brock was CANCOM fleet. You've summarized how, when you got there, the aircraft were doing, still doing, as in World War II, dawn-to-dusk patrols. And you found out that the flyers thought that the most they could keep overhead on a round-the-clock basis was one. Over a period of time, you increased that to four around the clock, four in the air around the clock. Have I covered everything about? Oh, these are the Maple Ridge exercises, aren't they? Maple?
No. That, Maple Royal were the old-fashioned ones that they were doing that were...
Maple what?
Maple Royal, they
Royal,
were
yes.
They were a century out of date.
A century out of date. Anyway, you had upped the air cover to four around the clock in your trackers.
Yeah, made the effort of the carrier worthwhile.
Yes. I think that was probably higher than any USN anti-submarine carrier.
At that time, yes.
At that time, yes. This paid off for you sometime later when there was a ship sunk off Ireland.
Not a ship, an aircraft.
An aircraft downed off Ireland.
Right.
You were about 500 miles away. You went towards her with two destroyers because that's all you could fuel. You sent the other two in. And as soon as you got within a probable range, you started flying off your trackers around the clock to find the site of the downed aircraft and found merchant ships picking up survivors. As you got closer, you transported the survivors back to you because you had doctors and hospitals, and so your round-the-clock flying with four trackers paid off in the case of this distressed aircraft.
That's right. And the ship got very nice recognition for the effort.
Yes. Then that will be on record in headquarters.
It will be. That's right.
Mm-hmm. So we don't need to dwell on what's on record except to indicate that researchers can look for it if they want.
If you... And also, if you wish to follow up that and find the date of it that it occurred, you'll find that there's that the action was acclaimed in our House of Commons. It was brought up by our politicians as being something pretty great. They've never had the Navy being thanked by the USN for anything.
Well, you gave talks on how to get promoted. I guess you should apply the same principles to make sure you get congratulated by the United States government, because then you'll be congratulated in your own House of Commons.
Well, we were just on the verge of really learning how to use an aircraft carrier in anti-submarine operations in this new role of around-the-clock flying, and we were using all kinds of new techniques which hadn't been used before, and ultimately the great pity was that just as soon as we reached the place where the aircraft carrier was the most valuable asset we had, scrapped it.
Yeah.
And Bob Welland took over for me as CANCOM fleet, and he was damn good at it.
We've left you as a post-captain in Bonaventure. You went back there as CANCOM fleet.
CANCOM fleet. That's when we really started to make the strides, because we could then design our own exercises and get something going. I wasn't very long there as CANCOM fleet, but Bob Welland followed me, and Bob was very good operationally. He was, you know, good at working out what should be done and how it should be done. And so then they really went right ahead.
Yes. Fine. Now you're a Commodore, and you've just left the Bonaventure for the second time.
Out here, Flag Officer Pacific Coast.
And then... Now, I met you out here when you were Flag Officer Pacific Coast. I think I was visiting from headquarters. Now, about those years, Brooke Claxton's integration, as opposed to unification, started to come into being. I think he started with the medical, dental, and post office people. Those common to all armed services, and integration of some of the features of the armed services did make sense to a lot of officers. For instance, it doesn't take an air commodore, a naval commodore, and a brigadier to order spare parts. So part of integration made sense to a lot of us. Do you think so?
No, I don't. I don't. I don't form a conclusion like that on the basis of medical amalgamation. Mm-hmm. That was so obvious that and dental and mm-hmm. Chaplaincy and things like the music school, basic flying. You know, it didn't require Brooke Claxton to get that thing set up. That was had always been in 1936, Army supplied all medical for all sea services. I don't know who supplied dental, but I think nursing training was done specifically by the Army for everybody and so on. No. That isn't really what Brooke Claxton did at all. Brooke Claxton, in my opinion, mm-hmm. Brooke Claxton started on the most idiotic pursuit of trying to get inter-service cooperation at all levels where it wasn't necessary, needed, wanted, or anything else. And he wanted certain things of the service to be similar. Now, what he did was this. There were three buildings in National Defense. Navy had the front building on Elgin Street, and then there was one on the other side for the Army, and there was one on the other side for the Air Force.
Yeah.
He built bridges to join these things up. And he put all the operational people for the three services in the front building. He put all the technical people for supply and so on in one of the other buildings, and the personnel people in the third.
Yeah.
So that now, and if you wanted to get anything done, you had to walk the city block. And he also set up a committee structure at all levels so that 90% of everybody's day was going to committee meetings and doing quite useless things. Now, that's what he did. Now, the next thing he did was to say that the rank structures had to be similar. It was silly that you have an army which would have, you know, a private and a corporal and a sergeant, a staff sergeant, a quartermaster sergeant, and then a bunch of other people. So we will have everything the same. Mm-hmm. Same number of ranks in service. Then it'll be easy for the politician to understand what's going on. So the Navy was forced to have a new structure for men with a P1 and a P2. and a C-1 and a C-2. And as far as the officers are concerned, they introduced Commodore's rank as a substantive rank. Mm-hmm. It had always been an honorary rank, and it was just so post-captains could run a place where there was all the captains couldn't come and just pick the best crews and things. That's what he did. It was the most unwieldy, unsatisfactory, idiotic move that was ever made, because it didn't make any sense to anybody. And you do it. You're told to do it.
Now, yes.
The rank structure that the Navy was given was still with us. And it's never been any good. We had no need for it. Okay?
Apart from the reason Claxton gave, yes, I can... Yes, of course.
During the wartime, you see, you don't want one service to do all the medical.
No.
You've got too many medical guys going to sea. You want to train your own people and teach them in damage control and teach them the things that they've got to know because they're going to sea. And you don't want to have to train all the armed forces in that.
No.
So in wartime, it's totally impractical, even for medical services. Dental service is probably okay because the little ships don't ever have doctors on board. And if you're amalgamating the service, you see then all the orderly type people, the people, you know, lab techs and all these other guys, you do so much unnecessary training because the Navy needs an entirely different kind of man than the Army. Mm-hmm. Right?
Oh, yes.
Well, I'll give an example. The dentists, there were two dentists and two dental technicians in Bonaventure. Well, we didn't train them in damage control. Nobody ever thought of it. You know, they're just dentists, they come on board. But, and it's a big ship, you know, they'll soon learn how to get through a bulkhead door and unclip it and clip it up. My God, they had a fire in their laboratory. Well, they didn't. We don't put out fires. They took off. And about 10 feet from outside their laboratory door was a gas line, F-gas line. Well, we were within striking distance of blowing the whole ship up. And it just so happened a pilot saw what was happening and did all the right things because he was properly trained. And there wasn't a catastrophe.
Who saw this?
One of our pilots.
One of your own pilots, yeah.
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 Now, that's probably a pretty big example, but and I think dental corps and chaplains, but I don't think medical corps can be amalgamated sensibly in wartime.
No, I can see all that. Ralph Hennessy said much the same thing to me in his tape of the post-war years. He said integration just was not working. It was just a mass of committees.
That's right.
And then, as you know, since we couldn't go back when unification came along, Ralph went with that.
That's right. But he didn't try to stop it.
No, I don't know. He didn't say he did.
Well,
no,
he never said anything in public.
No, he didn't.
No.
He didn't on tape either.
Well, he got a nice big fat promotion.
Yes, he took a double jump from Commodore to Rear.
That's right. He went
from Commodore to Vice Admiral.
That's right. Not bad, eh?
No, that same period, Bob Welland resigned.
Well, Bob Welland went out within 2 days of me. But he resigned, not because of, I don't know how much it had to do with unification, but he wasn't going to spend 5 more minutes working for Allard.
Yes, well, he told me that he still had X number of years to retirement. Mm-hmm. He just couldn't see himself soldiering on as a... And also, he and Ralph have been neck and neck all the way up, you know. I was with Bob Welland the day that was announced, and he said something to the effect of, well, Ralph, you've won. And he left the office that day.
Well,
I don't want to bring up the bitterness of these years, but I do want to ask just some questions that they've commented on that you might comment on, too. Charles Dillon was still in the Navy at the time, but he was just about coming to the end of his time. I should add here, parenthetically, that I was a passed over 2.5, and I was retiring anyway in the normal course of events. This was in 1965, so I was quite outside the emotional side of unification. I had my job assured as a lecturer at the University of Ottawa, and I was leaving in a little while. I asked Mickey Sterling about this. I said, you didn't say why you retired. And he said, no, I didn't. And he said, I'm glad you said it, because I was taught that if you can't work for men, you should just shut up and leave. Now, you're going to see Mickey tonight, but that's about the essence of what I'm not misquoting him. Now, other people have said things similar to that. I think, does Brock say he retired or was fired or that he...
Well, he knew he was fired. He was fired.
He was fired.
Yeah.
I forgot what he said in his book, part volume 2.
But
anyway. There
were 3 chapters on it.
Well,
it's the greatest mistake they ever made.
Yes, it's the greatest mistake the Navy ever made. He also has practically a whole chapter on his coming down the river from Chimnampo. We'll gloss that over. What I said to various admirals, and I've spoken to John Charles about this. Now, this was against our training, but knowing the value of a public statement, it had seemed to me, now, only me as an individual, that if all the admirals and the generals, and there were some Air Force that resigned, had stated why they were resigning, either before or after they did it, unification might not have gone on.
Well, if everybody had reacted against Heller at that time, and not all been yes men, he'd never brought it off. He couldn't fight the gang of us, but nobody fought. Nobody did a damn thing.
Now, one of the people who retired, up to Kenny Dyer, who stayed on for a while as vice admiral, and in Rayner's place.
He retired before unification.
He was the last CNS. Rayner had gone.
No, he wasn't. He was never CNS.
No, he was the last.
He was CNP and a vice admiral and a senior naval officer.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, what happened at Kenny Dyer was that he and Bob Monsell and somebody from the Air Force, not offhand anyway, I can't remember, but I did know, were put into a committee to look into unification and the practicability of it. They went back to Heller and said, totally impractical, don't do it. And he said, I'm going to do it. All just disappeared into the woodwork. That's all. They all just took their retirement, and not one of them said a word.
That's right. Now, I told you.
I didn't say anything either. You know that.
No.
No. Well, I didn't say anything until Heller started to breathe into the media a lot of narky things about people. You know.
Yes.
I left, and it was about 3 days after I'd been relieved in Halifax, and Jack Whaley, Canadian Press, phoned me up, and I was out in the field working, and he said, Bill, you've got to make a statement. Hedger's just pulling everybody to pieces and just wiping the decks with them. Words to that effect.
Yeah. Is that Brayley?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I said, well, thank you very much, Jack, for for telling me that. What's the essence of what's happening? And he just gave me a spiel about what Hedger's really doing, is saying that the rot in the armed forces today is entirely due to these senior officers, and we're bloody glad to get rid of the lot of them. Well, this wasn't true. He'd lost damn near all his good officers.
Yes.
So I hadn't yet been dismissed from my command. I'd been fired, but not I hadn't yet got the signal. So I went back to the house and called a press conference, and then took this statement of the ministers and let them have my views. But a lot of things had happened long before that. When I was flag officer, there was a press release.
FOPC?
By, yeah, no. Maritime Command.
FOAC. Yeah, Maritime FOAC, Commander, yeah.
Yeah. There was a press release with an Ottawa spokesman, which was printed in the Gazette and in the Globe and Mail, saying that the officers of the Navy were the Captain Bly type. They were hidebound with tradition, and their men really had no respect for them. This was published. So, this is not, is it?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Oh, it's all right.
Well, anyway, I wrote a message out, and the only message I ever sent to the minister, and I said that I wanted an apology from the spokesman in his office who released that press release, and repeated the message to Naval Headquarters. And about 20 minutes later, I had a message from Air Marshal Miller telling me that he'd like me to jump into an airplane and come up in Ottawa and see him at once.
Yeah.
So Ken Dyer met me at the airport, and he said, "You're for the high jump." And I said, "No, I'm not for the high jump. The minister has no right to make statements which are designed to create ill feeling between officers and men in the Navy. I mean, that's a criminal offense. He should be impeached for that." But I don't think it was the minister. I think it was a member of his staff, and I think I know who it is, and I think you do.
Yeah.
So he said, "Well, anyway, you're going to get hell from Marshal Miller." And I said, "He's going to have to speak awfully quickly once I get inside the office to beat me giving him hell, because he should have done this.
Yes.
He should have done what I'm doing."
Yeah.
So Miller started off by tapping the table, and he started to tell me, and I said, "Look, Air Marshal Miller, I'm not, as long as I'm in the armed forces, there's no one going to make statements like that to the press and get away with it. And what I'd like you to do, sir, right now, is to send for Bill Lee and put him on the mat. He's an Air Force officer. Mm-hmm. And in front of him, put him in front of me, and make him apologize. And if he doesn't apologize, fire him." That's what went on in Air Marshal Miller's office. Mm-hmm. And he wouldn't bring him.
No.
So I said, "Well, if you don't want to do that, I'm going to go back and I'm going to blow this thing wide open. I'm going to hit the fan with the whole story and say who did it and what kind of a person I think he is. And I'll put my name on it this time." He said, "You can't do that." Well, I said, "I certainly can. How are you going to stop me?" Mm-hmm. And later on, the same man said to me, "I thought I could control that minister, and I failed."
Yeah. That's the nub of it, I suppose.
Well, it was a bad time, but I don't think there was any way that anybody could change the entire career structure of officers and men without their consent. I don't mean that you have to say, "Well, you guys can vote as to what we're going to do."
Mm-hmm.
But at least they should have said, "If you don't like this, you can leave the service on good terms, take your pension and go. Every one of you can go. We what we're going to do this. But this was everybody's career. Not only their career, but the way they were going to have their traditions fiddled with, and their uniforms and everything else. So I just couldn't see how he could possibly expect to do that without at least giving the people a chance to say whether they wanted to serve in this unified force.
When Kai Burgold was making a lot of fuss around headquarters as a post captain, then he got the staff course. And the staff course is a sign of two things. Either it's a sign you're going ahead, or it's a sign that somebody wants you out of the way for a year. And I think it was the latter in the case of Kai. I see him every time I go to Halifax. He said that Lester Pearson came down when he was there. And, of course, you know Kai, he just boarded Lester Pearson about unification. And Lester Pearson said to him, Kai probably has told this to you, he said, if one more admiral had resigned, I was going to tell Heller to stop it, unification. And that seems a tragedy to me, that no one except yourself spoke out.
I think we can't talk
about other people's consciences.
A little bit far-fetched, but he later appeared in front of the Imperial Defense College and said, I didn't agree with what Hellyer was doing. He told
Pearson said
everybody was flabbergasted. I wasn't there to hear this, but everybody was flabbergasted because they said, well, if the Prime Minister doesn't like something, why does he permit his cabinet to do it?
Pearson has a lot to answer for. Who's running the country, if not the Prime Minister?
This is what I was going to tell you earlier. David Groos and I, the day I was fired, I was worried because Welland was going, Stirling was going, one other admiral, engineer, was going.
And Terry Bircher was going, I know. Was he the one?
Mm-hmm. Terry. And already Dyer and mm-hmm. Monsell and goodness knows how many others. So I got hold of David, who was the MP for Oak Bay, and he was the chairman of the Defense Committee.
Yes.
And I said, I think we ought to tell the Prime Minister what's going on. And he agreed. He made an appointment, and the two of us went to see the Prime Minister, all very polite, and no nonsense meeting. And I explained to him that I thought that he should be made fully aware that some of the very best officers in the armed forces were being either fired or they were resigning because of the activities of the Minister of Defense, and he was losing the very best people that we had, and I think that it was time that he was appraised of the situation and put a stop to it. He gave David Groos and I a drink, to keep us quiet while he went and phoned Tell Hellyer. Mm. And he came back and he said to us, he didn't say he was going to stop the firings or anything like it. He said, Admiral Andamon, Captain Groos, I give you my personal assurance that the traditions of the Royal Canadian Navy will not be altered. David and I went away. We were perfectly happy. How can you unify the services if you're not going to alter the tradition? So let's get on with doing something useful.
I can see that. Of course, it turned out that statement of the Prime Minister's had quite a different meaning, that we're going on with unification, but we won't disturb your traditions.
Well, how could they do that?
Yes, I know. He didn't say he would stop unification, is my point.
No, he didn't. But if I had got that in writing, if I had said to David, look, just for the record, let's get a witness and put this on paper. Because if we really do have the chips against us, we can read this publicly. The Prime Minister of Canada gave us this guarantee.
But it didn't
I was
happen.
Too naive for that.
Yeah,
I believe the Prime Minister was an honest, thoroughly sincere man.
Yeah.
Well, he wasn't.
No.
He never once denied it, or any time later on, all the time through unification, he never made a statement. It was always made by a spokesman. so that if we piped up, all he had to do was say, well, I didn't say that. It was a spokesman of my office, and he wasn't fully informed, but there's nothing wrong with that. That's happening all the time, because the Prime Minister can't keep track of everything.
Yeah, I can see that. Well, in retrospect, it's a pity that Moore didn't speak out, but their conscience was their guide, and we must respect their decision to speak or not to speak, I suppose.
Well, I can't understand why anybody who spent his life in a service which depends on esprit de corps and morale would not feel like speaking out.
Well, I too found it hard, but I had nothing to lose, and a lot of people had children in colleges and money to pay.
The 2.5s in Halifax gave me a going away dinner.
Yes.
Nothing but 2.5s. Did you ever hear about that?
Yes, I heard about it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's all I did. Tell me about it.
I'm not going to tell it for the record.
All right.
But
what you did tell junior officers was that although you might resign, there was no good anybody of their rank resigning, because it wouldn't make any difference at all.
No, that's not what I said.
All right.
It's something close, but what I said to all the officers that I spoke to everybody except lieutenants, all ranks, and in more than one meeting, 3 or 4 meetings, was that our first responsibility was defense, and it was not going to help defense if everybody resigned. So that if they were, that I would represent them as best I could in opposing this thing, rather than have other people trying to say, well, I'm going to quit to show them I don't like it. Mm-hmm. And so I have no doubt that in due course...